Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Syria state media and human rights activists said government troops and allied militias have captured a number of villages and towns in rebel-held eastern Ghouta near the capital. Syria's central military media said the government forces captured at least six villages and towns. But for thousands taking refuge, life has turned to huddling in basements and underground shelters. This woman says the conditions are deplorable. We're hungry. Our kids want milk. They want clothes. They want food. They're naked. We're consumed by dirt, mold, and destruction. We live worse than stray dogs. Please, everyone, for God's sake, have mercy on us, on the people of Ghouta. 600 civilians are estimated to have been killed in the past 2 weeks. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro said Sunday that President Trump is not planning to exempt any countries from his increase in tariffs on imported steel and aluminum coming from foreign shores. He told CNN that the final details on Mr. Trump's anticipated 25% tax on steel imports and 10% tariff on aluminum should be completed by later the week, in the week. On another news program, NBC's Meet the Press, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said there are a lot of false assumptions here.
Is that just because there are more people in the consuming industries, there'll be a net loss of jobs? That's not the case at all.
In 2017, the U.S. imported $151 billion more in goods from Europe than it exported to EU countries. China has added its voice to the growing chorus of concern. Speaking at a press conference ahead of China's annual legislative meetings, the vice foreign minister gave assurances that the rise of the world's second largest economy is no cause for alarm. This is VOA News. This Sunday, Italians are voting in elections that some analysts say could seriously impact the current makeup of their government. As Sabina Castelfranco reports for VOA, former 81-year-old Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has brought his center-right Forza Italia party into an alliance with an anti-immigrant league.
Rome resident Riccardo Frulli has decided the league is the only party that can bring change. He says Italy urgently needs to deal with the high level of youth unemployment, high taxation and public spending, as well as immigration.
In this moment, we have a lot of problems, like the huge flow of migrants that are approaching every day our territory. We have also a below average security level, with most of the people that have a bad feeling of danger.
The populist and five-star movement, which did not exist 10 years ago and is headed by 31-year-old Luigi Di Maio, could emerge as the largest single party. Di Maio has made clear he wants to lead the country's new government, and his party will make no compromises or join forces with others.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday urged her party to sign off on a deal to form a new coalition government with the center-left Social Democrats after she struck the deal. Reuters' Scarlett Svetanovich has more.
The successful vote now clears the way for a rerun of the grand coalition that has governed Germany since 2013. The SPD initially planned to go into opposition after a disastrous result in last year's election, but agreed to negotiate after Merkel's talks with two smaller parties on a three-way tie-up collapsed in November. SPD leaders have hailed the thrashed-out coalition agreement for its commitments to strengthening the European Union and giving them some key government roles. Merkel could be sworn in for her next term by the middle of this month.
Turkish army troops and Ankara-backed militants occupied several key points, including Sheikh Hadid strategic settlements, within the framework of Operation Olive Branch against Kurds in Afrin region. Sources say that the Turkish army men and their allied militants stormed Kurdish positions and captured Sheikh Hadid. They went on to say that Sheikh Hadid is one of the most important settlements in Afrin region. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is planning to send a high-level special delegation to North Korea Monday to discuss ways in which relations can be improved and to ease tension on the peninsula. After the two-day visit to North Korea, the South Korean special envoys will travel to the United States to brief American officials on their discussions in Pyongyang. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is away on assignment.
The 100 Days by Emmerson Ndamuzo Mnangagwa represents the mother of all political shenanigans in this country, the mother of greatest incompetence to have seen deplorable political developments in our country.
It's almost 100 days since Zimbabwe got a new president. Now some Zimbabweans share their thoughts on the new administration.
These children had been kidnapped by some suspects who took them into an inn deep down in the quarter in Kyosi. They administered some toxic product.
Cameroonian authorities say they have dismantled a network of child traffickers responsible for dozens of abductions in the region over the past several months.
The issues that we have conveyed to the government of Uganda, it included allegations of misconduct and fraud and corruption as well.
And the UN Refugee Agency introduces a biometric registration system for refugees in Uganda to verify data and prevent fraud. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. It's almost 100 days since Zimbabwe's new president assumed office and promised Zimbabweans a new era that will usher in prosperity. He's been saying the right things and making the kind of promises the general Zimbabweans want to hear. For VOA, Kuzai Vinavashi speaks to some Zimbabweans who share their thoughts on the first 100 days.
Speaking at his debut appearance at World Economic Forum in Davos, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said he wanted people to judge him as he leads the country into a new era, one without long-time ruler Robert Mugabe. At home, he had promised a raft of changes within the first 100 days of his administration. Thabani Moyo is the spokesperson of Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition.
Well, it depends from where you're standing from. I think from the administration itself, it will definitely say it has made impact, mainly because it will be recording the number of trips they've made and engaged with various stakeholders. But in realistic terms, there was never a target to say we'll measure it by unlocking, let's say, $1 billion of investment. So you can't measure what you don't know.
Gift Ostalos is with Tajamuka, a social movement that was critical of Zimbabwe's former president. He says Mnangagwa has failed.
The 100 Days by Emmerson Ndamuzo Mnangagwa represents the mother of all political shenanigans in this country, the mother of greatest incompetence to have seen deplorable political developments in our country, for example, harassment of vendors, harassments of ordinary citizens, particularly the death that was caused by police. And we have also seen in the complete militarization of state institutions.
Tendai Biti is the president of opposition People's Democratic Party and a member of MDC Alliance, which is a grand coalition mounted against the ruling party ZANU-PF. He was the finance minister during the government of national unity 10 years ago. He is not convinced that there have been any sound developments in Mnangagwa's administration.
Open for business is just a slogan without substance. This government needs to walk the talk, and to walk the talk of reforms. They are not prepared to do that. The economy is tanked up. People are suffering, poverty levels are increasing, unemployment is increasing. What he has learned in the last 100 days is that people don't eat slogan.
However, economist Kipson Kundani says there has been some positive developments in Mnangagwa's first 100 days in office.
From a qualitative point of view, I think a lot has happened in the growing positive sentiment across many business players and also the renewed hope and optimism under his rule. It has been tremendous. One other issue is also the ability to stabilize the volcanic price increases. The inflationary pressures were really very, very strong.
Kundani says there are some issues this administration could easily fix, such as corruption. He adds the credibility of the forthcoming elections will be incisive in sustaining the goodwill that prevails. Moyo says Mnangagwa could take advantage of some low-hanging fruit, such as potential reforms being considered by the country's legislature. They include the review of some media and electoral laws that would ensure the country is on a democratic path. The government has recently released a report saying the three-month moratorium that gave a window to anyone who externalized funds to bring back to the country without any questions asked has been a success. Over 250 million of externalized money has been repatriated back to the country. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Meanwhile, some 700 Zimbabwean refugees who fled to Botswana during the bloody 2008 presidential election say they want their safety guaranteed before they return home. Some lost their homes during a deadly crackdown on opposition supporters a decade ago. Last week, the new Zimbabwean government called on the refugees to come back home. From Habarone, Botswana, Martin Ngwenya reports for VOA from there.
Wasu Chibi was an active opposition MDCT supporter in his rural province of Masvingo in the run-up to the 2008 presidential election in Zimbabwe. The often violent and deadly poll pitted two men against each other, then Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and his erstwhile rival Mr. Morgan Tsvangirai. Mugabe's ruling party supporters unleashed a reign of terror, displacing Chibi and hundreds of other opposition supporters, some who fled into neighboring Botswana. Scores were left dead. Today, there are 700 Zimbabwean refugees staying at a refugee camp in Dukwi, just outside Botswana's second city of Francistown. They've been reluctant to return home despite pleas from the host government, which argues conditions have improved in Zimbabwe for their safe return. This week, following Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa's visit to Botswana, the refugees were again asked to return home. This time, the plea was not from Habarone but from Harare, where Zimbabwe's Home Affairs Minister Obed Mpofu said there was no need for them to remain in Botswana. But Chibi, who is a spokesperson for the Zimbabwean refugees, says they cannot return without any guarantees of their safety from authorities in Harare.
Of Zimbabwe now want all refugees back home to Zimbabwe. Then we requested that they should give us a representative who is going to come to Dukwi. He is going to answer the questions that we have and maybe actually give us the way forward. How are they going to receive us since we've been in hiding for all this? And is the ground level enough?
He says they've already been given forms to fill out, indicating that they want to return home, but the refugees want a Zimbabwean government representative to address them first. Another refugee, Agnes Chiwaza, also wants answers before she considers returning home.
How do we go back to Zimbabwe after our families were tortured, our homes were burnt down, and as a result, there was a lot of disintegration? We need an assurance from the government that things will be sorted out.
The Zimbabwean government has agreed to send a representative to Dukwi, although no date has been set for a meeting. Refugees fear that as Zimbabwe prepares for another election, violence might actually flare up. This comes amid reports that ZANU-PF supporters are intimidating their opposition counterparts. This as politicians on all sides prepare for an expected election in June. Home Affairs Minister Dr. Mpofu claims after the Botswana visit last week, his country was initially not aware that there were Zimbabwean refugees in the neighboring country. He says they must return home, but will undertake a further fact-finding mission to Botswana soon. Reporting for VOA's English to Africa service, this is Martin Ngwenya in Habarone, Botswana.
The Malawi Electoral Commission says it will continue engaging political parties and other stakeholders to address their concerns ahead of next year's general election. The electoral board also says it would be implementing improved measures to better organize the elections. My colleague Peter Klote caught up with Shangwani Mwafulirwa, spokesman for the Malawi Electoral Commission, who is part of the African Union's poll observer mission to monitor the Sierra Leonean election, and began by asking him how ready the Electoral Commission would be to organize next year's elections.
Well, if you look at the elections management, all the electoral management bodies, they are moving towards what we call the electoral cycle approach. And in this electoral cycle approach, you have what we call the pre-elections period. This is whereby you do all the preparatory work, and now you move into the elections period. Now, for the Malawi Electoral Commission to come up with the launch of the elections, what we are telling the stakeholders is that we are almost done, or if not done, with the preparatory work. We have done the analysis of the 2014. We have taken necessary measures in preparation for these elections. Now, we are starting the game, getting prepared. Now, we're also bringing them together to inform them in advance of how we have prepared for these elections. Because what we need is for each and every stakeholder to take an active part. Most of the times, people always complain that we are not given enough time, we are not informed in time. Now, for us to coming to this launch elections is to put the ball also in their court that this is what we have planned for. Registration is going to start in May. Now this is February. Can you put your houses in order so that when we start registration, we want you political parties also to participate by pressing your monitors. We have given enough time. Can you prepare, train your people? Because when it comes to evaluating whether the elections have been free, fair and credible, you don't just look at the issues that have taken place on the polling day or on the following day, but you look at the entire process. So as we start with the registration, we want these people, all the stakeholders, to participate, whether it's civil society.
So talking about registration, will that be biometric kind of registration where there could be cross-check and balances so that there is no doubt about the credibility or transparency of the voter list that will be used for the election?
Yes, we are having a biometric voters register, but we are doing it this way. After the 2014 tripartite elections, all stakeholders agreed that we should migrate to the biometric voter registration. Now, coincidentally, in Malawi, we are also having a national exercise because we might have been the only country in Southern Africa without the national register. So there was a national registration bureau that was registering all citizens above 16, and they are continuing that. So what we did was to draw synergies. They did the national registration. They did the biometric registration of everyone. Now, what we're doing is that the Malawi Electoral Commission is going to use the national registration card in doing our registration. So when we bring the national registration card, we just scan that one and get the text details of the person. Using the text details that we've gotten from the national ID, we are going to get the biometric details, the fingerprints and the faces of all the people from the database of the national registration bureau. By doing that, we have also developed our own biometric voter registration system, but drawing synergies from the work that was done by the National Registration Bureau. So when people come for registration, they should not expect that Malawi Electoral Commission is going to take their fingerprints or take their pictures. No, that job has all been done by the National Registration Bureau and will not duplicate it.
Yes, that was my colleague Peter Klote in Freetown speaking to the spokesperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission. Cameroonian authorities say they have dismantled a network of child traffickers responsible for dozens of abductions in the region over the past several months. The network is said to have extended into neighboring Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and Chad. The investigation intensified after three young children were found dead in the back of a truck. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Kiosi in southern Cameroon, where angry residents have torched a hotel owned by the alleged traffickers.
Hundreds of people are still visiting the neighborhood where an inn was razed last Tuesday by angry residents of Cameroon's southern town of Kiosi on the border with Gabon and Equatorial Guinea. 39-year-old Vanessa Nzali is among those who arrived on Friday. She says she had traveled about 280 kilometers from Cameroon capital Yaoundé when she heard that unidentified children had been found there by Cameroon police. She says she immediately decided to travel to Kiosi to see if her missing 11-year-old daughter was among the children.
Elle était partie à la source pour puiser l'eau. Elle a vu une voiture.
Nzali says 4 months ago, she returned home from work and was informed by her neighbors that her daughter went to fetch water from a well and 4 men forced her into their car and drove off. She says her neighbors also told her there was a baby crying in the car. Kwetong Henderson Konge, the most senior Cameroon government official in the Ntem Valley Administrative Unit that includes Kiosi, says the inn was raised after a car belonging to its owner was found with 3 dead children aged 2, 4, and 7 years old.
At about 2 p.m., their parents started looking for them and could not find them. These children had been kidnapped by some suspects who took them into an inn deep down in the quarter in Kiosi. They administered some toxic product and these children went off. They now put these children inside bags and tied them and put all of them in the back boot of the vehicle.
Henderson says 15 people suspected to be members of a network of child kidnappers operating in Cameroon, Gabon, and Equatorial Guinea were arrested when investigations were opened. In 2016, the Yaoundé-based Interpol Office for Central African States reported that thousands of children alongside men and women were forcibly abducted in Cameroon, Chad, Central African Republic, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and the Republic of Congo to be used as combatants, cooks, guards, sex partners, servants, messengers, and spies. Patricia Asta of the local non-governmental organization Children's Rights says child kidnapping has increased in Central African states because many childless couples and mothers are ready to buy from the black market. She says some are forced to serve as commercial sex workers, while others are recruited or kidnapped and then transported to faraway places where they are forced to work as pickpockets, beggars, and drug transporters. Asta says within the past several months, at least 26 cases of abductions have been reported to her NGO, with parents saying their children either were tricked, forced, or persuaded to leave. She says they also have had cases of children who were held for ransom.
Nous initions des actions visant à sensibiliser les parents et aussi à sortir certains enfants des griffes.
She says they have decided to educate parents to be very vigilant, and they are asking all victims to join their association lawyers in legal processes that will protect and free children from predators who are out to destroy mainly naive teenagers. She says it is her wish to see to it that all child traffickers are punished. Cameroon, according to the 2012 Trafficking in Persons Report of the U.S. State Department, also is a source, transit, and destination country for children subjected to forced labor and sex trafficking. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kiosi, Cameroon.
The UN Refugee Agency is introducing a biometric registration system for refugees in Uganda to verify data and prevent fraud. This follows a scandal last month in which 4 Ugandan officials were found to have fiddled the refugee figures for their financial benefit. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Uganda provides protection to about 1.4 million refugees from South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burundi. The government has been praised for its generosity and open-door policy for people fleeing conflict and persecution. But a major corruption scandal last month, reportedly involving millions of dollars and the exploitation of refugees, has tarnished the country's image and cast doubt on the credibility of its asylum policy. 4 government officials have been suspended and are under investigation. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Barbara Balosh tells VOA the biometric verification system is important to fix discrepancies in Uganda's refugee data. He says this new registration process will ensure that the thousands of refugees who are arriving daily in Uganda receive the assistance to which they are entitled.
The issues that we have conveyed to the government of Uganda, it included allegations of misconduct and fraud and corruption as well. There were many questions around the credibility of the data which is in Uganda's government registration system. UNHCR used to do registration until 2015. Then Uganda took it upon itself, and since then we have been raising issues.
Earlier this year, Balosh says Uganda's prime minister accepted UNHCR's office to put in place the latest biometric verification system. Registration has begun in the Orichinga refugee settlement in Uganda's southwest region, home to thousands of Congolese refugees. The UNHCR says this massive exercise then will be rolled out to cover more than 30 locations across the rest of the country. It says biometric checks also will be introduced at 180 food distribution sites. The process is expected to be completed by September. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In advance of International Women's Week, a report by the Inter-Parliamentary Union finds little progress is being made in increasing the number of women parliamentarians around the world. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IPU headquarters in Geneva.
Before 2016, the Inter-Parliamentary Union reports the number of women being elected to parliaments around the world was increasing annually on average by 6%. But it says this encouraging upward trend seems to have come to an end. Over the past 2 years, the IPU finds the number of women in national parliaments globally has increased only by about 1%. It says women represent fewer than one quarter of world parliamentarians. IPU Secretary General Martin Chungong says women are faring better in countries that have electoral quota systems than in those that do not.
So this actually calls for more countries to adopt quota systems to try to level the playing field. We need more and more women in parliament to create a critical mass so that parliamentary decisions and outcomes are adequately informed by the interests of both men and women. And this is a very major factor for legitimacy, for effectiveness in decision-making processes.
A look at the IPU's league table of 193 countries shows a number of bright spots. As in past years, Rwanda comes out on top in the rankings, with more than 61% women parliamentarians. Senegal, in ninth position, outranks 10th-placed Norway, with nearly 42% female representation. These compare favorably with the United States, which ranks 100, with a dismal showing of just over 19% women lawmakers. Regionally, the report finds the Nordic countries leading. It says Europe, which has made the greatest gains in the number of women MPs, also recorded the greatest losses. It shows some improvements being made in Latin America, with Argentina, Chile, and Ecuador as trailblazers. IPU says sub-Saharan Africa has stabilized at nearly 24%, and Algeria was the only country in the Arab region to hold elections for its legislature last year, while female participation in Asia's electoral process remains low. The report says the Pacific region, with 15.5% women MPs, holds up the bottom of the rankings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, sports and music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And in Nightline Africa Sports, video assistant referees, or VARs, are said to be used at this year's World Cup in Russia after football's lawmakers voted to approve the technology. VAR has been tried in some domestic English Cup games this season and has been used in Italy and Germany. The International Football Association Board unanimously approved its introduction on a permanent basis after meeting in Zurich on Saturday. Leagues and competitions must now apply to the International Football Association Board to implement the system. FIFA President Gianni Infantino said the decision on whether VAR would be used at the World Cup will be taken at a meeting on March 16th. The Premier League is not expected to introduce VAR next season, and UEFA has already said it will not be used in the Champions League next season. Meanwhile, 20-time tennis Grand Slam champion Roger Federer has won the 2017 Loretta's World Sportsman of the Year and Comeback of the Year awards. The 36-year-old Swiss won the Australian Open and Wimbledon titles in 2017 after nearly 5 years without a major. Serena Williams took the World Sportswoman of the Year award after winning her 23rd Grand Slam in 2017. Formula One Constructors champion Mercedes picked up the Team of the Year accolade, and wheelchair athlete Marcel Haag won Sportsperson of the Year with a disability. Also at the ceremony in Monaco, golfer Sergio Garcia secured the breakthrough prize following his Masters success, while recently retired Roma forward Francisco Totti clinched the Laureus Academy Exceptional Achievement Award. Brazilian football club Chapecoense were given the best sporting moment of the year for their response in adversity following a plane crash in 2016 in which they lost the majority of their team. And in athletics, at the IAAF World Indoor Championship Birmingham 2018, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba, the 2015 World 1,500 meters champion, finished a comfortable 0.96 seconds clear of the field in 4 minutes 05.27, only the second woman to complete a World Indoor 1,500 meters and 3,000 meters double. Gabriel Szabo of Romania accomplished the feat in Mabashi in 1999. It was the fifth individual World Indoor title for Dibaba, who won the 1500 meters in 2002 before a hat-trick of 3000 meters successes in 2014, 2016 and now 2018. Only four other athletes have achieved that tally. That is Maria Mutola, both seven, Ivan Pedroso and Stefka Kostadinova, five. The energetic Anne Edwards was in Birmingham and caught up with the winner, Genzele Dibaba.
Genzebe, two gold medals at the World Indoors. Are you happy with that, two gold medals?
Of course, I'm very happy. I'm really happy. Yeah.
What can you do in the summer? Break world records in the summer?
Yeah, my plan is in 5,000. Maybe I try world record, yes.
Genzebe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, Britain's Mo Farah beat Kenyan Daniel Wanjiru in a sprint finish to win the inaugural big half race in London, with Callum Hawkins coming third. The four-time Olympic champion on the track was racing the 13.1 miles half marathon as part of his preparation for the London Marathon in April. The 34-year-old Farah is attempting to become the first British male winner since 1993. Britain's Charlotte Perdue won the elite women's race, with Lily Partridge a second and Charlotte Ashka coming in third. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, and now it's time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Scoopy. Different. kama Fanta na Coca. Kampuni moja but mindo na gonga. Hey, gonga, mindo na gonga. Yemi yemi mami, dakupa deli deli darling. Twende na ina ina mi, tupate baraka zangai. Nasema yemi yemi mami, dakupa deli deli darling. Twende na ina ina mi, tupate baraka zangai.
for everyone where they the canteen. Now we don't upgrade the matter. Daily and weekly and monthly and quarter. Now we don't talk to butter. Family this smile and we know get quanta. That we just say Yoruba. Make them no go forget say Badona Baba.
Yes, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last Friday morning, militants attacked
the French embassy and the military barracks in Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso. This was not the first time that there has been attack by militants. In two previous years, there were deadly attacks also in Burkina Faso with huge casualties. The pattern has been that the jihadists were attacking Western citizens or Western installations, buildings, or hotels where they are staying. It must be recalled that in October last year, many Americans and congressmen were stunned to find out that four Americans have been killed in the desert in Niger, a country many of them know little about. And the question was being raised, what are American troops doing in Niger or the Sahel? Currently, France leads a 5,000-member multinational force, which includes troops from Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, Chad, and Mauritania. They are trying to combat terrorism in the region. The question is, how long can the Western countries sustain casualties on the African continent? In the recent attack in Ouagadougou, reports are that 4-8 soldiers were killed on the government side and 8 from the jihadists. But there were about 80 civilians who were wounded by the jihadists in their initial attack. One has to ask, what is being done in West Africa since many of these countries being led by France are members of ECOWAS? In East Africa, the East African countries have found a way to cooperate in their fight against the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab. But before talking about the need for a new architecture in West Africa, one must recall what the founding fathers of the Organization of African Unity, OAU, proclaimed in the 60s and 70s. They urged all African states to refrain from joining either of the two military alliances then in existence, NATO and the Warsaw Pact. They went further to urge all Africans not to allow military bases from foreign countries on their soil. Now, these prescriptions are now more honored in the breach than in the observance. It is true that ECOWAS at the first sight of the jihadists in West Africa did make an effort. They tried to form a peacekeeping force in Mali because Mali became embroiled in the jihadist movement following the fall of Gaddafi in Libya and the push south by the jihadists. They went to the Security Council asking for authorization in the hope of getting funding and logistics. They were partly rebuffed, and shortly after, the French elbowed them out by its own unilateral intervention in Mali. Later, that French intervention in Mali was converted to the current United Nations peacekeeping force in Mali. And daily we are hearing of casualties in that force. What should be done now with ECOWAS? ECOWAS has had a very good history. One should not forget that at a very difficult time in the history of West Africa, General Bambadika, in cooperation with ECOWAS, formulated a security blanket in the form of what was called ECOMOG. ECOMOG succeeded not only in holding the tide, but protecting two African countries, Liberia and Sierra Leone. So if in the event that the West may want to withdraw, it is wise to consider whether they could not assist ECOWAS in providing the security required in the fight against the jihadists. They have proven the capacity to do so, and it will be prudent that they receive full international support. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Our Nightly in Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer tonight, Wojtek Zonjak, we thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you all the best.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's democratic political process got a boost recently with help provided by the United States. U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria Stuart Symington joined more than 40 prominent Nigerian politicians and International Republican Institute, or IRI, President Daniel Twining to launch a new activity supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, to help political parties adopt better governance practices and improve the quality of political discourse. Implemented for USAID by IRI and Search for Common Ground, the three-year, $5.5 million Responsive Political Party program will help the major national political parties in Nigeria improve responsiveness to their constituents. It will also contribute to creating peaceful participation ahead of the upcoming elections. The activity promises to help parties contesting the upcoming elections to become more representative of the citizenry and improve the oversight of government programs. It also aims to increase the frequency and intensity of political party interactions with their constituents, improve communication among party officials, candidates, and office holders at all levels, and boost the participation of marginalized groups in political processes and within the parties themselves. The Responsive Political Party program will also help spread the message of peace and nonviolence through the electoral process, determine early warning signs of electoral violence, and formulate strategies to mitigate potential violence through conflict assessment in conjunction with political parties and civil society organizations. Working with IRI on this project, our parties will be stronger and more efficient, vibrant and responsive to the yearnings of Nigerians, Deputy Senate President Ike Ekemeremadu remarked. I assure you of the cooperation of the National Assembly towards the actualization of this noble initiative. If you seek to be followed, tell the story not only of what is wrong, but what you would do right for the future, Ambassador Symington told the assembled politicians. And the greatest right you can do is to inspire your members to come together and make Nigeria better.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.